My text is Acts chapter 12, verse 5. It's nice when I get to fill, and I don't have to worry about all these other details. I just let all that work out, and I'm supposed to give a word. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. The operative word is earnestly. Well, I'm going to go up here now. Are all these microphones off? No feedback? Okay, good. Thank you again, Justin, for all your work. I want to talk to you about fervent prayer. I've talked to Dan. It's on his heart. I believe it's on, I know it's on the heart of our elders. Not just fervent prayer. I want to talk to you about earnest prayer. Earnest prayer. Desperate prayer. That's what earnest means, okay? Serious prayer. Focused prayer. That's what earnest means. Continual prayer. Participative prayer. Purposeful prayer. Even perspiring prayer. I want to talk about earnest prayer. Earnest prayer is commanded in Colossians 4 when we're told to be devoted to prayer. It's assumed in Matthew 6, as Dan will continue on in the Sermon on the Mount. It's not something we can opt out of. In fact, it's our privilege to be able to go to the Almighty Sovereign God of the universe and pray earnestly in this time we live. I want to give some practical suggestions that I've talked to Dan about that he said, go for it. But before we get there at the end of my message, we need to talk about this greater text. So I want to pick up at Acts chapter 12, verse 1. Please bear with me as I read an extended text. And I do need to warn you, if you by chance doze off, I have a tendency to ask questions. So I even name names. I won't do that to newcomers or visitors. I'm not saying I will, but I have been known to do that. I like interactive discussion, I guess. First one, Acts 12. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. When he saw that this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After arresting Peter, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial, interestingly, after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying for him. The night before, get this, the night before Herod was to bring him to trial and then have him executed, Peter was sleeping between, get this, he was sleeping between two soldiers, okay, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared, and the light shone in his cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him up. Quick, get up, Peter. And the chains fell off Peter's wrists. Then the angel said to Peter, put on your clothes and sandals. And Peter did so. Wrap your cloak around you and follow me, the angel told him. Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and second guards and came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them by itself. And they went through it. When they walked the length of one street, I'm adding the word interestingly, suddenly, the angel left them. Peter was on his own. Then Peter came to himself and said, now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating. when this had dawned on him, he went to this is a very interesting text. This, look at you guys, without going into a long deal on historicity and reliability of the scriptures, I would argue this text has the hallmark of eyewitness accounts, because this is pretty funny. I mean, you had to have been there to get this text, okay? It wasn't just, in my estimation, invented. It's interesting. So when this had dawned on him, verse 12, Peter went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people, not a few, okay, many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked at the outer entrance, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed, she ran back without opening and exclaimed, "Peter's at the door." And of course, Peter was at the door, still outside, knocking away. "Come on, let me in, Rhoda, what's the deal?" I thought that was kind of a funny passage here. Isn't this true to life, though? Look what these mighty spiritual giants of the first century church do. So we think. "You're out of your mind," they told Rhoda. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said it must be his angel. That comes out of their old Jewish, somewhat superstitious beliefs, incidentally. But Peter kept on knocking. Still outside. Is Herod going to send his police after him? Are they going to let him in? And when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. "Tell James and the brothers about this," he said, and then he left for another place. In the morning, as you can imagine, this tragic. There was no small commotion among the soldiers as to what had become of Peter. Those soldiers knew what was going to happen to them as a result. After Herod had made a thorough search, or had a thorough search made for him and did not find him, he cross-examined the guards and ordered that they be executed. Wow. Then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea, stayed there for a while. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon. For now, they now joined together and sought an audience with him. Having secured the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, Herod, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a God, not of a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died. So, the word of God continued to increase and spread. The crisis that generated this earnest prayer by the church comes out of the reality of the presence of evil that went frontal, that went open, that went direct in the world. King Herod Agrippa I was the brother of Herodias, okay, the woman who had arranged for John the Baptist's head to be chopped off earlier. The grandson of Herod the Great, the king who had tried to kill the baby Jesus. He was a member of the Jewish Hasmonean royalty, so technically, at least by nationality, he was a Jewish man, but he was brought up in Rome where, through the intrigues in the Roman capital, he'd gotten to know the right emperors who came to power, and ultimately his star was on the rise after AD 41 because he was appointed by the Emperor Claudius, where he was given additional lands, including this area of Judah, as part of his kingdom. He was a Roman puppet king, as Rome delegated out its rule in the Mediterranean world. Now, you got to understand the politics here, okay? Let's make sure we understand what's really going on here. We're at AD 44, so you know we've had over a decade or so the church meeting. The church initially was seen as just a Jewish sect. For the most part, we have isolated outbreaks of persecution before this, but the leaders of the church had never been hit, had never been marked. Now, of course, Satan's behind this, but if you go back into Acts chapter 10 and Acts chapter 11, you'll notice that not only is the church in Jerusalem growing, but is starting to move out deliberately and intentionally with the conversion of the Gentile, the Roman centurion Cornelius, to take the gospel not just to Jewish people, but to Gentile people. That made the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem very uncomfortable. That was a no-no. They felt threatened. At the same time, Herod, in order to sustain and maintain his rule, needed to court political favor with the Jewish leadership. The Jews as a whole were not an easy people to rule. So we got a little deal going on here, and that's what lies behind Herod courting the favor of Jewish leadership, and evil goes open. James, brother of John, is killed with a sword, and it appears that Peter is going to be killed as well. Interestingly, if I can take a little side trip, look at Josephus, the Jewish historian who writes about, in fact, some of the things that we have in the New Testament documents, chronicles as well the death of Herod, and all the details stack up. Josephus says Herod was killed in Caesarea. Josephus says Herod was dressed in bright, special robes, befitting a king of that era. Josephus says he was proud, getting the recognition, the flattery of the crowds. That's the way kings operated. Josephus says Herod died suddenly. Now, in Josephus' case, it just says it's a stomach ailment. We know that Josephus, later on, after the fall of Jerusalem, was very interested in courting Roman approval, so it wasn't appropriate for Josephus to go into the grimy details, the account of the worms eating Peter, that our New Testament documents appropriately include. Now, we got another issue, you guys. Look at verse 3. This is what the text says. When Herod saw that this pleased the Jews. Now, we got to be careful here. The new Bible that has come out, today's NIV, is different than the NIV we've been using. But the new Bible, today's NIV, makes all kinds of inappropriate changes in the text. It's, in fact, a politically correct Bible. Here, it doesn't say the Jews, it says the Jewish leadership, but that's not what the text says in the original. It says the Jews. Now, you think about that, and then you think of all this controversy surrounding what? What's the big controversy, you guys? The new movie. The Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of Christ. Now, who killed Jesus is a question we need to ask. And I might add, back in this time, in the first century, the Jews were a majority, and they were, for the most part, a powerful and prosperous majority. A lot of history has gone under the water since. And in the name of Christ, not legitimately so, but in the name of Christ, unspeakable horrors have been committed against the Jewish people. We need to be sensitive about that. On the same token, we need to be honest about what the biblical text says. In this case, the Jews were pleased with Herod's barbaric actions. But let's clarify, okay, who killed Jesus? Who killed Jesus? Well, the Jews did. Biblical text says that. Biblical text clearly says the Romans, the Gentiles, also killed Jesus. And you know what else the biblical text says, you all, my good people? It says you killed Jesus, and I killed Jesus. So let's be very clear, not apologetic, but clear about who killed Jesus. And I read this morning, it's my understanding in the Mel Gibson movie, we're all going to go on the Evangelism Task Force when it opens a week from Wednesday. If you want to come along with us, let me know, or one of the young people, or somebody from the task force, if you want to go along to check it out for ourselves. But very bright people say it's a well-done movie, appropriate to the scriptures. And it's my understanding that Gibson's hand, I don't know how this works, I haven't seen the movie, okay, but Gibson's hand is superimposed on the picture when the nails are driven on, or driven into the Lord, with the clear indication, who killed Jesus? Mel Gibson knows who killed Jesus. Mel Gibson and his sons killed Jesus. So let's be clear, sensitive but not apologetic. Well, incidentally, I agree with Al Mohler. Albert Mohler is the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He said much, and we look, I don't have a problem with honest dialogue and questioning, okay, but I think he's right. He says much of this controversy about anti-Semitism is phony baloney. It's not about anti-Semitism. It's about the fear of the Hollywood elite seeing evidence in a I don't want to say in an attractive way, but in a visual and real and appropriate way, in a biblical way, put on the screen, as people, as Mohler is quoted, as people see this film, the right answer to the haunting question, who killed Jesus, will be evident. Now, I'm just getting leery. Again, I don't want to overstate the case, but it seems to me, if you look around, what's going on in the culture, some of what is called tolerance, compassion, classic liberal or broad-minded attitudes is really nothing more than a veiled effort that might become more frontal to keep Christians in their place. And we need to be aware of that, you all. We need to be aware of that for our children. Those are the indicators in the culture. As Americans, and we fall into this, we all admit intellectually there is evil, of course. We don't do so well about acknowledging the presence of evil, because we try to be, as Americans, we're trained to be loving, tolerant, accepting. If we just work with people, they'll respond graciously. I mean, that's the way it is. Diana put me on to a really good novelist. I don't read novels very often. I like to read history. That probably makes me a little bit odd, but when I do read novels, I'm reading, maybe some of you have read those new books by, I'm blanking out on his name. Yeah, Joel Rosenberg, former political correspondent for World Magazine. He's written two great novels, The Last Jihad and The Last Days. And he wrote the first book, The Last Jihad, before we got involved in the war on Iraq, and the setting takes place at the end of this decade, so it's a very interesting read, and pretty smart guy. A lot of terrible things happening, everybody's getting blown up. And the hero of the story, who's not a Christian, at least early on, a guy by the name of John Bennett, is a man who's really bright about some things, but he's really, like, we guys can be really dense about some other things. And eventually, there's a dialogue in a passage in the second book, The Last Days, and he's one of his friends and advisors is a guy by the name of Dr. Mordecai, the fictional former head of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. And Bennett asks this guy, Dr. Mordecai, well, what is going on? Everybody's dying and blown up, and unforeseen things are happening despite the best efforts of Washington and our government to keep a lid on things. And Dr. Mordecai looks Jonathan Bennett right in the eyes and says, you Americans just don't understand that this world is full of evil. And he said, Bennett, you've got to come to terms with it. Evil is lurking all around us. Doesn't it appear to be becoming more frontal in the culture, more open? It's even being celebrated in the culture. I don't know what that means, but I do believe the reality and presence of evil for ourselves and for all of our loved ones around us who we care about, and for the good of our nation, for the good of our culture. It should drive us, this reality of evil, to not only prayer, but earnest prayer, fervent, desperate, serious, focused, continual, participative, purposeful, and, if you would, perspiring prayer. But this passage, fortunately, doesn't just talk about evil. It also talks about opportunity and God's power. Especially, I mean, look, you can look at the immediate context. What was Peter doing in those first three verses just before he knew he was going to die? That was his expectation. The text suggests that, implies that. What was Peter doing? He was sleeping. Was he sleeping restlessly, or was he out cold? What does the text suggest, you guys and ladies? The text, in fact, what does the angel have to do? Look at you guys, listen. If you look carefully in those Bible verses, one of you guys want to pretend to be asleep? Come here. Okay, this man's asleep. Hope you're not bored with the sermon. What does the angel go up and do? This is a mean angel. What does the angel go up and do? Look at the text. What does it say? What does it say? The angel strikes him in the side. It appeared to me that Peter was out cold. How do you explain that? He's about to die. How can you explain that? We're speculating, but I think fairly so. What was the church doing? The church was praying. How was the church praying? Earnestly praying. Now, here's the deal. But there's more here. Not only do we have evidence of God's power and presence right at this point, if we won't do this thoroughly here, I would take too long. But if you go back into Acts chapter 12, you will notice that the most incredible event has occurred, one that shapes all of our lives to this day. A Gentile church, not a Jewish church, not a Jewish Christian church, but a Gentile Christian church begins up in the great Syrian city of Antioch. And if you go over to chapter 13, which is immediate to our context, what does that church do? What does that church do? It sends out whom? The Apostle Paul and his partners on the first missionary journey. Now, there are mysteries in life. Which way does the Apostle Paul go from Jerusalem? Does he go east or west? Yes, he goes to Europe. Now, ladies and gentlemen, most of us are of European heritage, and our European forefathers were the most pagan and rude and crude people who are into child sacrifice and all that horrible kind of stuff of all the peoples in the history of the world. Europe was the primitive spot in the world. But for reasons that we don't have to fully understand, Paul goes west into Europe. Ultimately, from all that, Paul's work, Europe is evangelized. Our forefathers are evangelized, and they brought their faith to this country when they came as immigrants. We ought to be beholden to that. That process begins here. Now, let me ask you another question. Do you think that the Christians in this church knew the long-term ramifications of the work of God in the world that was going on around it? Scott Pickering is going, no, I think you're right, Scott. How could you possibly know the great work that God was going to do over the course of human history to this point? In terms of what God's people are doing, God was working his plan all around. What were God's people doing? What was a hinge point in terms of human activity? You know what the hinge point was in all this? Prayer. What kind of prayer, you guys? Earnest prayer. Earnest prayer. Fervent, serious, I think desperate's a fair synonym. Look at, maybe we're not desperate. We should be. Evil is lurking at the door. We cannot be naive. Focused prayer. Doesn't earnest mean focused? Continual, participative, purposeful, even perspiring prayer. Now, you put that first quote up, Justin, Steve. Here's the deal. Prayer brings power. Isn't this a wonderful statement from a guy from old named Baxter? Men may spurn our appeals, reject our message, oppose our arguments, despise our persons, but they are what? They are helpless against our prayers. Recently, I was up to see my friend John Hokey. We helped with his mailing, and he called it. He likes to have little parties and have people in, and I always meet the most interesting people at his house. He had a friend of his from India who's in charge of a growing church growth movement in India. This is an Indian native. He was in America, I think, raising support, I believe. He thought, poor man, thought I was a pastor and might be able to have my church help him, but then that's not the case. And a fascinating man, though. I think a man who was full of God's power. You know what this man told me? Maybe he is going to help our church. Because he told me a story I'd like to share with you, if I may. You know, there is a growing urbanization movement and modernization movement in India, but over 500 million people in that great Hindu nation still live out in rural villages the way they have for thousands of years. Historically, there has been a Christian church since the days of St. Thomas in India, but the Christian church, such as it is in India, is primarily in the cities, not in the villages. So this man's vision was to start interdependent churches in the villages. They said, I thought to me, a very ambitious goal of starting 2,000 churches about 15 years ago, wasn't it, honey? Guess what happened? Within a couple of years, what happened? There's been a revival in India. 2,000 villagers' churches and 2,000 different villages were started. So they upped their goal to 6,000. They met that within a few years. Then they said, well, we're going to try to plant with God's help 10,000 churches. I kid you not, this is verifiable stuff. 10,000 new churches. Do you know what their new goal is? In 2010, how many churches they want to have now? They want to have 100,000 village churches in 100,000 different villages in India. Now, that was kind of humbling information for me, and we got to talking about some other things. And you know what came out that night? The pastors meet together in little regional areas. Most pastors in the villages don't have cars or automobiles, so they meet, I guess we would call them in districts. And the pastors meet twice a month. They meet one time to plan, strategize. You know what they do on the other time? Guess what they do? Yeah, they pray. But you know what they do when they pray? They pray for the entire night. It's earnest prayer. Opportunity. The power of God's presence. Opportunity that we can't even visualize. We can't even conceptualize. Maybe as our children go out from here to touch a needy world, it's prayer. Now, earnest prayer, fervent, we'll do it again, desperate, focused, purposeful, prioritized, perspiring, participatory prayer. Now, let's talk practical. I got to have a qualifier, and I think if we qualify what we have here, we're not talking about going hyper-spiritual here, okay? Or we can get messed up and Satan can trick us that way. Look, I got to ask you guys some questions. Verse 12 indicates that not and the verses that follow indicate that not all the Christians in Jerusalem were at this particular prayer meeting, because what does Peter say when they finally figure out that he's there and they let him in finally? He says, go tell who? Go tell James. That's the brother of our Lord, who incidentally was known for attending prayer in the temple every single afternoon until his death when he was martyred 15 or 20 years later, and go tell the brothers. Now, the brothers weren't there. I honestly don't know. I don't know if anybody knows for sure who the brothers were. Was this just a woman's prayer meeting? I don't know. But not everybody was there. I'm sure some were praying, but let's be honest. We're not called just to prayer. We're called to work, aren't we? There are a lot of things that got to be done to make a church work. We can get very spiritual and say, well, prayer is a higher purpose, and people who pray are sort of superior. Well, that the text doesn't support that. In fact, it's fun to analyze the biblical text. Look here. Look carefully at verse 17. Okay, could you look carefully at verse 17? When Peter's finally, they let him in, right away, Peter, and he put that picture of the city up, okay, Steve. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet. Why does he do that? I help with this picture. It's not the clearest picture, but look at, do you see how close people lived to each other in Jerusalem within the city walls? Okay, we're not talking about country estates, okay, with a half an acre in between each home. Now, come on, let's use our wits. Why did Peter shush him up? Come on, be quiet, you guys. What's going on here? Yeah, I mean, they might as well open the window, such as windows were, open areas in the wall and say, hey, Peter's up here. Come and get him. God's going to protect them. No, you don't do that. You got to have some wits. Okay, you get it? Now, let me build my case to be sure I'm not just reading into the text, because I don't think I am. That's why I'm grateful for our elders, because I know they're spiritual men, but they got business wits, something I don't have. You got to have wits to run a church. Look at, where did Peter go? Look carefully at the text after verse 17. Where did Peter go? Where? Douglas, where? It doesn't say. Why is that? He didn't want to be found out by, come on, Herod. I mean, you saw how many guards he had. Do you think Herod was going to take this sitting down? I don't think so. You got to use your wits, okay? Sometimes when we talk about prayer, we can get so spiritual that we forget to use our wits. But on the other hand, may I dare say that the problem oftentimes with the American church isn't with wits, but it's with prayer. Aren't I right, if we're honest about that? Don't we sometimes get so programmed for activities because that's the American way, that prayer is not done deliberately, it just seems to happen, that prayer becomes kind of an add-on or a tack-on, and that we really lose the privilege of having earnest prayer? Let's go back to verse 5. Doesn't verse 5 indicate the priority of this church? How does it describe the church as a whole? Earnestly praying. Okay? Now here's the deal. There is some practical encouragement here, because let me reiterate. We have this tendency to think that these first century Christians were pretty strong in their faith. You know, many of them actually met Jesus before he went back to heaven, you know, in his physical presence in this world. They had what we, they had believing faith. Name it and claim it, okay? Come on. What kind of faith do these believers have? Based on this, I think, very honest and revealing text. What kind of faith do these believers have? It appears to be the case. The only faith they had was, we better be praying because that's all we know what to do. And God will take us at that point. And as we learn to pray more effectively, maybe our faith will grow. Now, may I offer some practical suggestions to help us perhaps move even further along the journey of earnest prayer? Okay? One concept I like that I find helpful when I'm in a, and maybe this is just me, but it's, you know, take it for what it's worth. I like the concept of topping. By topping, I mean if you are in a prayer circle and somebody prays for prayer request X, instead of praying for prayer request Y, I think it's so helpful when the next person also prays for prayer request X. And maybe another person can pray briefly. You don't have to get all wordy and spiritual-like in our words. Somebody else prays for person or prayer request X, then that person can introduce prayer request Y. That's the concept of topping. I also think we need to do some very good thinking about continuing to establish some different focus points for prayer in this church. I'm so thrilled about the prayer chain because that meets a certain need. We have a wonderful prayer meeting on Sunday night. Some people hit me up with a request after the first service. We need to form a prayer effort before the worship services on Sunday for Pastor Dan and the worship people. We cannot assume. You know, we have such wonderful and talented and gifted worship people. Maybe it's not done deliberately. Maybe we assume that, and God has been present in this church. Maybe we take that presence a tad bit for granted. Okay? That's an idea I'd invite you to consider. I think the other thing is, and here's the deal, when you pray before a sovereign God, again, there are mysteries to this. I'm not going to try to explain those, but sometimes I look at my own prayer diary. Sometimes you get incredible immediate answers to prayer. And sometimes you go, oh, yeah, a year later there's an answer to prayer. But sometimes you get, maybe a lot of times, you get those no answers. Now look, here's where we got to think and pray for wisdom. Is God taking us maybe toward a different way of viewing things? Maybe we need to back off of our prayer requests. But there are times I think God is testing us and we need to stay on task. So in general, I would ask you to consider in your own prayer efforts to not only top, not only to think about how we can do so creatively, but how we can stay on task. Now, let me say this as I move toward conclusion. Now, I have some freedom because I'm not an elder, I'm not a pastor, although Dan knew where I was going, so I find it to be my privilege to speak in that sense on his behalf. But can I throw out a bold idea? Now, this isn't official, this is just my idea. Maybe it's wacky, maybe it's got some merit. Remember, we got to have some wits, okay? Don't forget about that side of the equation. I think there might come a time if we really want to see God's presence in this church. I mean, look at this issue of property that we're facing. I was so encouraged by our annual meeting to know that the elders and Pastor Dan didn't try to come up with a scheme about property just to come up with a scheme because there is some uncertainty right now. Okay? Look at in the Kent School District. Despite a lot of wonderful, dedicated efforts by those serving within that organization, if we're really honest, they don't say it like this, but they really won't let a Christian Bible club be on campus at Kent Ridge High School. We got some issues that we need to be praying about because that one has not been resolved. Okay? Could I propose that there might come a time, once in a while, and we can see how it goes, that we shut everything down in this church for a week and just pray? Everybody's kind of looking at me. Whoa. I don't know. I think there are some creative ways we could do that. Maybe, for instance, on Sunday night, for the most part, youth groups would stay together. But we don't have our normal program. We pray. Okay? And could you think about that? We always want to add prayer before or after. That's not going to work. We need to make prayer, perhaps in new ways, part of the program. If we're serious about what kind of prayer? Earnest prayer. One more request, as I'm part of this group, and this also serves as a fellowship opportunity for my wife and I. It's been a wonderful privilege to be part of the Sunday night prayer meeting. But you know what? We need help. I'm going to be straight up. We need help. We got a problem. On the one hand, we want to be praying for revival for some of these great issues in the culture that we have to be praying for. But there is a strong desire as well among the participants. You know, when you fill out those sheets for prayer requests, you know what we do on Sunday night? We try to pray for those. But there's not enough time to do all that. Something's got to give. we've wondered, do we need to form two prayer groups on Sunday night so we can strategically address the needs before us? We need help. Just please think, use your wits, but be open to what the Holy Spirit says about earnest prayer. The days are evil, Paul says in Ephesians. Only God knows what's going to happen in this culture, especially for younger people. We're going to follow Jesus Christ. But the days also, if they're evil, are full of opportunity that we cannot even imagine. If we pray earnestly, if we pray fervently, I think we need to pray desperately. If we're serious about prayer, if we're focused in prayer, if we do it continually, if we do it participatively, if we do it purposefully, and if we do it with some perspiring, who knows what God just might choose to do now and in ways beyond that we cannot even imagine.